for what is episode 22 of Our Curious World. I'm talking with Richard Freeman, the Zoological Director of the Centre for Fortean Zoology, based in North Devon. From the cfz.org.uk website, the largest professional scientific full-time organisation in the world dedicated to cryptozoology, the study of unknown animals. And since 1992, the CFZ has carried out an unparalleled programme of research and investigation all across the world, active in conservation, cryptozoology, education and community work, publisher of more than 100 titles in print of Fortean and cryptozoological topics. So with the rebirth of their web TV series On The Track and a new book getting published, Richard and I jump straight in there with a conversation about trolls.
Trolls, because they were so elusive and so savage when cornered. The descriptions of them were much more massive than human beings, covered with shaggy hair, big brow ridge, flat noses, immensely muscular. Females had long drooping breasts, and they could lift huge rocks that no man could lift or hurl them. The descriptions matched up exactly from these ancient Danish records with eyewitness descriptions, contemporary ones, I was getting from the Caucasus Mountains of the Almaty, the wild man of Russia. And the descriptions were exactly the same, and Lars and I matched these up, and they were just the same. Now, in northern Sweden and Finland, there are still reports of trolls. Over the Russian border, in the mid-80s, there was a mass sighting of an almasty in the Kolar Peninsula. A bunch of youths aged between 14 and 18 saw this, and also a park ranger.
Wow.
They camped, they'd made this camp, and this thing haunted the camp, hurling rocks, coming up and banging on the cabin door, scaring the bejeebus out of these. And there must have been about two dozen youths saw this, and no one would believe them. They thought they were just kids making up stories. And eventually, the parks department sent a guy down, thinking that they might have seen a bear, and it scared them. He saw this thing too. And they nicknamed it Alfonia. And it was supposed to be about 8 feet tall, greyish brown hair, leathery skin, ape-like face. And this is close to the borders of Finland and Sweden. And these troll reports still happen in northern Sweden and parts of Finland. So these hominids are occasionally straying over from Russia into Europe.
Well, yeah, because when you look at those reports of that they would always be under bridges, I can remember reading reports of where they'd have like ogre nests, which I find is quite interesting because, of course, silverbacks do that. They create a weave on the floor around where they sit, and I was like, an ogre nest appear to say sort of the same thing. And I guess trolls too. They would hide where there's natural shelter, which I guess under a bridge or in the back of houses appears to be exactly what they would do.
And there's the old legend that trolls, if they're struck by sunlight, they'll turn to stone, which may be based on the fact that they've become nocturnal to avoid competition with modern man. We know that chimpanzees in certain parts of Africa have become nocturnal to avoid man.
Interesting, I didn't know that.
Legends, there are always a spark of truth, a grain of truth to all legends. For example, dragons, they are one of my favourite subjects. There are dragon legends in every single culture on Earth.
The fact that the word is pretty similar in every culture as well, I find is quite interesting.
There's a folklorist called Michael Wetzer who's traced them back, and what he did was look at folklore and legends using a phylogenetic tree, which is similar to something that biologists do. They look at shared derivative traits, and he's found out that a lot of our old favourite fairy tales, like Rumpelstiltskin and things like that, and Beauty and the Beast, they go back much, much further than we thought, not just hundreds of years, thousands of years. And he traced the legends of dragons to sub-Saharan Africa at least 40,000 years ago.
Well, so I guess there's the stories of like the Draco, and certainly in northern China I've seen reports, and their dragons are quite interesting. The descriptions, the fact that they are flying creatures, they appear to have scales that almost are metallic, they appear to cast fire out when they in the sky that is a danger to people. They appear to have wisdom. I find those characteristics are quite interesting, as well as the sometimes animalistic aspects. But they appear, it's as odd as it sounds, they appear to be almost like vessels or vehicles. I know that.
I've heard that story, and when you look into it, there's nothing to it. Absolutely nothing to it at all. Nothing at all. The dragons are reptiles. They're always described as reptilian. In the Orient, they're godlike creatures.
Yeah.
Associated with rainfall. Their breath condenses and falls with rain. They have this long serpentine form. They're very wise. They can control the flow of water. They're not usually aggressive unless you provoke them. In the West, they're associated with fire, the element of fire, but also they live in and around water in wells and lakes and things. But they're malevolent. They're always seen as negative, breathing fire and poison. But they're always looked on as creatures. In the earliest legends, they're more god than beast. They're more godlike. Things like Tiamat. And from Sumeria and these other cosmic serpents, they're more like godlike creatures. But as we move into medieval times, they take on a more sort of biological, physical form. And there are stories of them in things like the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which was a series of books that wrote about the history of Britain. And they record historical events and other things, but they also record dragons being seen, and they record them as news stories of the day.
Yeah, because you find a lot of towns and cities and families have a dragon within their family crest. So I don't. That's right.
Charter legends. And it's how that family got the power, and it's usually that they slew a dragon. It's a convenient story. To give them the excuse for having that power. But it's like the layers of an onion. Where did they get the idea of the dragon from? It goes back and back and back, and it's always this gigantic reptile in all cultures. And even today there are modern day sightings of dragons, particularly in Asia, but not just in Asia. So in 2007 there was in Ohio, in a place called Oconto Falls, there was a mass sighting of a dragon by numerous people, and they describe it as being white. Its scales were white. It had four legs, a long tail, long neck with a wedge-shaped head, these big bat-like wings. And they said when it spat fire, it wasn't a jet of fire, it was a ball of blue and orange fire that came out of its mouth.
All right. Loads of this thing. So was that like floating, or was it with wings? Or
flying like a bat.
Oh, right. So I wonder how it generates the fire, or biological fire. I mean, that's intriguing.
The other thing is that they have hydrogen gas in the belly, and it's
just one second. Sylvia, I wouldn't bother answering it for now. So my door is knocking, but I've got some parcels that are due, so they can just get set back elsewhere.
Yeah.
So the dragons, I mean, they are. So what other creatures kind of come down history like that? I guess like the unicorn does as well, in much the same way, into family crests and stuff.
Fascinating creature, the unicorn. If you look at medieval depictions of the unicorn, it's not a horse. It has cloven hooves like an antelope or a goat. It doesn't have the single hoof of a horse. And there was a prehistoric form of antelope called Procanthoceras that instead of having two horns backwards from its head, it had the two horns very close together and pointing forward from the skull. So in life, they would have been covered with one sheath, and it would have given the animal one horn.
Oh,
that was about a million years ago in Europe, but it's not impossible that bones could have been discovered, or there could have been relic populations of them until much later.
So yes, they're also seen as being wise, or they have some, there are mystical powers of some kind.
Yeah, Yeah, the horn is supposed to negate poison. It's supposed
Yeah,
to
because
cause.
I guess in terms of, say, ancient people or people with superstition, they would have seen that in the same way they China sees kind of all creatures, really. They give them powers of like aphrodisiacs and so on. So I guess if you found a creature that was quite elusive, you'd want to take on and imbibe its power.
Funnily enough, Marco Polo, when he described seeing unicorns, he said, "Oh, they're not the white-furred, graceful creatures we think of. They're really great, huge grey things with a single massive eye, highly aggressive." And he was talking about Indian rhinos.
Ah, I suppose yeah, he would have been because that's what he would have seen, obviously on his journey into Africa and into the Middle East. Oh, Marco Polo, his chronicles, they were the first people to start writing things down. What have we found along the way and back?
And he also talks about dragons. He also talks about dragons in the Far East, and he said they have huge jaws, great long bodies, and they all devour anything they can get their teeth into. And he wrote of them as having legs and coming out at night, coming out in the lairs at night, and people being terrified of them. And it probably wasn't describing crocodiles, because this sounds like something entirely different.
Yes, I want to wonder what it was they were seeing. So we hear now, like you read the press, and you're seeing things like all animal species, 70% have been wiped out during the time of man, and you kind of wonder how many creatures are disappearing, or what have disappeared in more recent times. What's disappeared perhaps in the last 2,000 or 5,000 years, particularly characters that have made it way into myths and legends and stories and folklore that are handed down orally, yet are technically within the. They're within the memory of people and story.
We've seen the functional extinction of the northern white rhinoceros recently. There's only two females left in the entire world.
Yeah.
And the rhinos have been forced into extinction because of mythology similar to that of the unicorn horn. The idea that powdered rhino horn is a sort of cure-all, and it's worth more than its weight in gold. Complete superstition. Rhino horn is keratin, like worth the fingernails.
Yeah.
So basically, rhinos are being hunted into extinction because of fairy tales.
It's incredibly sad, isn't it? It really is.
The only way to stop that, the only way to save the rhinos, that all the countries that have wild rhinos in them have a shoot to kill policy for poachers. Don't try and capture them alive, blow their heads off. And
Yeah.
then you go after the dealers in Vietnam and China and take them down. Because that's the only way you'll save rhinos.
Do you think there's a perhaps a what's the word for it? There's not encouragement, perhaps, but I see things in the paper like going $50,000 to the person who might want to kill this last endangered creature. I'm like, you what? Why would anyone do that?
Yeah, there's countries like, I think it was Namibia, that was charging some arsehole American with a gun thousands and thousands of dollars to go and kill a black rhino.
Yeah, and you're going, so what are they now a trade? Are they an economic asset? So how many runners do we have? Well, we have 50,000 of them. Well, that's 50,000 times 100 grand. That's enough for us to have our next level of tank.
They're worth more alive as a tourist attraction.
Yeah. That's as long as people go. I guess when the countries are, I guess at war or they're in a situation where things aren't unstable, though, that keeps people away.
Anybody involved in stuff like that, I absolutely condone the killing of.
Yeah, absolutely, I understand. So there was a I was on a I was a guest actually on a radio show some 2007 2008, and there's a guy whose name I always forget when I come to try and remember it. And he's a cryptozoologist himself, and he was the main guest on there. I was covering the news, and he said something to me what has actually stuck with me this entire time, and it said that. If people saw something they didn't explain, they couldn't say. So if they saw an animal they couldn't explain, the problem is that most people have never even seen animals that they know and to describe. So most people have never even seen a badger or a deer. So how do people describe a creature that perhaps isn't known to science?
Yeah, that's more or less what Debbie Marta said when describing the orang pendek. She said she was so dumbfounded by it that she found it difficult to describe. Because she was expecting a bear to, or something to walk into that clearing. Or if the orang pendek existed, she was expecting it to look and act like an orangutan. Sumatra, the orang pendek, the name means short man, is found on the Indonesian island of Sumatra. And it's been reported as far back as the days of Marco Polo, who wrote about these hairy wild man living there. And in the days of the East India Company, Europeans would have encounters with these creatures. It's said to be 3 to 5 feet tall, covered in long dark hair, usually black or grey, very powerfully built, and have a strikingly human-like face.
Is that because perhaps they don't have hair on the face? Do you think that would have been an evolutionary path? Because I guess orangutans don't have much facial hair, do they, generally?
Apes have no facial hair, they have a clear face.
Yeah, I guess we do. So I have always wondered, I mean, again, just kind of diverging conversation here, and I really apologise for that. Someone described to me as, are humans, in fact, apes that were in water? And that's why we don't have any hair on our bodies, or as less of.
It's the aquatic ape theory. And there's theory that at a certain time in our evolution in Africa, we started to exploit foodstuffs that were in the water. We were going into the water a lot more. That's how we lost our hair, because it gets water clogged in. And that's why we stand erect, because we're walking around in the water. There are a couple of big problems with that theory. One is, if you're going into the water in Africa, you're going to get eaten by crocodiles. They're more dangerous than any of the animals on land. They'll take down a fully grown lion like that.
Yeah.
You're going to get eaten. Also, we know that bipedalism isn't solely a human thing. We know that certain fossil apes were bipedal now, and it's been suggested that instead of becoming bipedal when we went out onto the savannah and were having to stand up and look around for predators, bipedalism started in the trees, where we're sort of balancing on branches and lifting our arms up like that. Orangutans do this and balance like that on branches, and that's where the first bipedalism came from.
Oh, okay, I didn't realise that. That's really interesting. So, with the orang pendek then, so the islands that are around Sumatra, how many, does each of the islands have its own unique hominid?
Well, we think that the orang pendek is a ground-dwelling form of orangutan, a ground-dwelling, new species of ground-dwelling orangutan. I found some hair that was examined by Lars Thomas at the University of Copenhagen, and he said it's related to the Sumatran orangutan, but distinct from the Sumatran orangutan. Now, the whole landmass of Malaya, the Malayan Peninsula, Borneo, Java, Sumatra, it was all one landmass once called Sunda. And when the ocean levels dropped, Sumatra, Borneo, Java all became islands, separate from the Malayan Peninsula. But long before that happened, the orangutans had split and speciated with the Bornean orangutans and the Sumatran orangutans. They were genetically separate before the splitting off of these islands. And more recently, we found, just a couple of years ago, a third species of orangutan that lives on Sumatra called the Tapa Nui orangutan, totally distinct from the Sumatran orangutan, which lives further north. So we think that the orang pendek is the fourth species of living orangutan, but one that is adapted to life on the forest floor. It's upright and terrestrial rather than being quadrupedal and arboreal. So there may be three species of orangs on Sumatra. The Tapa Nui orangutan, the Sumatran orangutan, and the orang pendek.
Well, that's a... So you kind of make sure to have any other species of hominids also exist in areas around the world that have, you know, wild fauna, where they can stay away from humans. They are almost completely isolated. that have had an opportunity to evolve and grow into their niche for that environment. I mean, I guess, is the American Midwest and as a Northwest still a viable place for hominids also to grow, like the Bigfoot legends say?
Yes, yeah, because of course it was attached to Asia once by the land bridge, for India, the land bridge. And of course, we have stories of the Yeti in places like Tibet, Nepal, northern India, and Malaya, and places like that. I went on the trail of the Yeti in the Garo Hills in northern India, and I talked to a number of witnesses from the hill tribes who had nothing to gain by lying, and they were all describing the same animal. Black fur, the Yeti isn't white, it's black or dark brown. They said it was very like a gorilla, but with long black hair and standing on its hind legs. And they all quoted the height to be about 3 meters, 10 feet. Most of them were very afraid of it. They saw it doing threat displays, rather like a gorilla, shaking vegetation and bellowing, and they ran away. One guy said he saw it, one of them building a nest. He was on a hill looking down and he saw one of these things make a huge nest on the forest floor, rather like a gorilla does. Another guy was a hunter who saw one in a forest clearing, and he said it was down on all fours, like as if it was searching for something, some sort of food source on the forest floor. Once again, it described it as looking like a huge gorilla.
That's incredible, really, isn't it? So,
tracks, these human-like tracks by the jungle stream, and they're about 12 inches long, so it's probably a sub-adult, if it was the Yeti. The guys who were with said they found tracks 19, 20 inches long. And whatever it was flipping over boulders that no human could have moved. And it seemed to be feeding on freshwater crabs, the remains of freshwater crabs.
Oh, right. So I guess that would be a viable food source, that'd be high in protein. So, yeah.
Another guy said he saw a female eating bamboo and suckling a youngster. He said he'd heard these stories, thought they were rubbish, until one day he saw one in a grove of bamboo. It had its back to him. It was suckling the youngster, and it was eating the bamboo.
Wow. So, is it, what areas of the US are they generally more reported? It is the Northwest, isn't it? I'm sure I've heard stuff like Miami area, but that never seems to make much sense because I'm pretty sure the jungles there aren't so good.
The Pacific Northwest, in that those cold northern forests.
Because they're relatively unexplored, aren't they?
Yeah, there are massive places in Canada and the northwest United States that are very remote. And then you get the skunk ape down in the subtropical areas, like Florida and Louisiana and around there. Things like the Falk monster, which seems to be slightly smaller and more slender in build than the northern Sasquatch. And then you get weird ones from the Midwest, odd ones that just seem to turn up for a while, scare a community, and then and move away again.
Because I did see there was a video that surfaced like last year. You've probably seen it yourself from Yellowstone Park. There was a number of Yeti-like creatures seen as a family moving together, but I never saw anything apart from the original video that came from that.
It's always been, for some reason, it's the Asian ones that interest me the most, the ones that far more.
Well, it's weird. I think in America, it's almost seen a bit like a hobby, a bit like a paranormalist hobby. As where professionals, like yourself, or those who are interested in the zoological side of it, seem to take it much more serious. And why do you think there is that kind of distinction?
That's a good question. I think a lot of people in North America, because it's not on their doorstep, they can just go out at a weekend if they're living in the right area. And just go and probably on that sea or the Chinese Yeren, I have to mount a big, carefully planned, expensive expedition.
Well, talking of that, so you said you've secured funding for two major trips coming up?
Well, I've been in contact with people that say they want to fund expeditions. I have a lady who wants to remain anonymous.
Okay.
That is wanting to fund an expedition next year, and an organisation that said that they might be able to have a whip round for funds for another expedition. And I'm probably going to be making a documentary with an American film crew, possibly going back to Mongolia. So, you know, if things work out, I might be doing three expeditions next year.
Excellent.
For next, which would be the most I've ever done. I've done two expeditions in the year before. Because it's all down to the folding green stuff at the end of the day.
It is, yeah, because you have to maintain yourself while you're there, pay your crew, pay the team. You know, film stuff takes time, editing takes time.
Get there. The snow leopard is an example I always give. We know snow leopards exist.
Yes.
But in the 1970s, they tried to film them in the wild for the first time. And it took them 6 or 7 years to get film of them in the wild. Now, when I'm on a cryptozoological expedition, I can afford to go for 2 or 3 weeks a year. So you can see that the odds are really stacked against me.
Yeah, because I guess how many times are you, again, I mean, apart from, say, giving cameras to the locals and saying, oh, I'll be back in a year, perhaps. Can you take some videos if you've seen a bit?
If I had the money, I'd go to these places for months on end rather than just weeks. I'd be months in Sumatra or Tasmania and places like that.
So how's the culture out in Sumatra? I mean, how is the Pendek associated into their culture? Is it something they see and know and it's one of those things they wave at? Or is it part of their mythology? How do they see it as part of their day-to-day life?
No mythology to it whatsoever. The last time I was over there, we got a huge amount of witnesses together. We talked to about 20 people. We got them all together. Who had seen these creatures over a very wide area of Western Sumatra, all describing the same creature. None of them gave any supernatural elements to it whatsoever. They think it's an animal that lives in the jungle that's rare. One guy said he saw it in an old graveyard that had been sort of, was on the edge of the rainforest, and it was a bit overgrown, and he saw it stand up from behind a gravestone, and at first he thought it was a ghost because it was in a graveyard. And then he realised it was this animal, the Orang Pendek.
So I wonder what they think of us. You know, what they see effectively what something that looks a bit like them, but a lot taller. Do you think they are, in terms of an alpha state, they're like, I'm just going to back away from that?
They try and avoid human beings, even though they're massively stronger than a human being. Hugely strong. I've going to hear stories of them tossing logs around that no human being could possibly move. One guy who said, a guy called Mr. Pimple, he said he saw one. It reminded him of Mike Tyson.
Really?
It was so bulky. It's, you know, it's its shoulders and the way its head sat down on its shoulders with little or no neck. It's so muscular. And but they have been moving into this area called the garden, which is a semi-cultivated area between the rainforest proper and cultivated areas, where they grow crops in this slightly overgrown semi-rainforest area. And we've had stories of them raiding crops. So one guy said one smashed its way into his shed and stole his sugar cane. And there are a lot of sightings from this area, which is very promising indeed.
Well, I guess that would make sense because they see the food as readily available and it's easy to access. I suppose they're going up in the trees and going through the rigmarole that they normally go through. It's happily available.
Another thing that interests me is tool use with these things. You hear stories of the Yeti using rocks, hurling down rocks to smash the skulls of yaks and things. And the Orang Pendek is supposed to use tree branches or fallen sticks like a club, or occasionally use a sharp stick like a harpoon to spear fish out of rivers, which is fascinating. The Almasti is supposed to use clubs and rocks to hunt with. And famously, Zaina, the one that was supposed to have been captured in the 1850s, it was said that she would bang rocks together, which sounds almost like she was making a primitive stone axe.
Well, right. Maybe even sound, like it, the fact that it makes, in some way, that kids knock things together and they makes it sound like a bell, or like they tap things just so they can experience it. And I guess that any member
the whole tool use is things like the Yeti and the Sasquatch and the Ramping and the Almasti. Fascinating.
Yeah, because it's almost like they're at Stone Age level.
Yeah, Apes use tools. All the known apes use tools for various things.
So when do you think that they'll... So if we're looking at apes as, say, a Stone Age man now, effectively, you know, what do they need to do to, you know, hit the next level, if we're looking on them in that sense? To start fire?
That's a sort of false idea of what evolution is about. Evolution doesn't have a goal.
No.
It's constantly making itself better. That's the Victorian view with us humans at the top of the evolutionary pyramid, the apes and monkeys beneath us and going down. It doesn't work like that. Evolution is about adapting to your environment. So if there's no evolutionary pressures to change, you won't change.
No, you're right. You're right.
So they use the tools they need to get on with. A good example is sauropod dinosaurs, the long-necked dinosaurs. As their necks got longer, their brains got smaller, so they wouldn't have to pump as much blood up, you know, 40 foot of neck to feed their brains. So it's not always about improving, it's about adapting to what you need.
That's a fair point. That is a fair point. So what other cryptids are on your radar as things that perhaps you're not investigating actively, but that are grabbing your interest?
Well, the other thing that really interests me is the Tasmanian wolf, the thylacine. I've been down to Tasmania 3 times now, and I've interviewed so many witnesses, good witnesses, old ex-loggers that have seen this creature. And there's been a government-licensed shooter who goes out and kills feral cats. He's seen it a couple of times. And if you look at eyewitness reports, they're from some great people. Like there's a zoologist called Hans Narding who saw one of these things from only 20 feet away. And if you don't know what a Tasmanian wolf is, it's a flesh-eating marsupial, very dog-like, but with tiger-like stripes down the hindquarters. Supposedly hunted into extinction on Tasmania in the 1930s, the last one dying in Hobart Zoo. But since then, there's been 4,000 sightings of these things, and it's been called the healthiest extinct animal to ever meet.
I can see why.
That was absolutely fascinating. And like I said earlier, Tasmania is the size of Ireland, but if, when you get over to the west of it, there's nobody there, it's just wilderness. But the population on the whole of the island is less than 500,000, concentrated mainly in 2 cities.
So there's a lot of space for nature to grow, to evolve, to adapt to that environment. And I guess if you were a creature with no human interaction or no rivals, you're probably going to thrive in that environment.
And back in the 19th, early 20th century, the people that were familiar with the thylacine, they said its smell was very like that of a hyena.
And all right.
On an expedition, I was on a remote path in the forest, and I got this smell. I used to be a zookeeper, and this smell was just like a hyena. It was as if something had just gone past a few minutes before and left this scent trail.
So what is that scent? What's it an aid or what does it do? Is it just to ward off? Is it to distract or annoy? Or
it's probably a similar way to other animals use it. They use it to mark out their territory, but the general aroma of the animal is like, you know how dogs have a certain smell.
They do,
yeah. The thylacine is meant to smell like a hyena. And this, whatever had been across this track moments before, while I was walking on, smelt like a hyena.
So I guess you were ready to jump off the track and go find it straight away.
Sadly, I didn't see anything. We set up some camera traps, but they didn't get anything. But it's one of those, I think it's one of those close calls. Another time I was in Russia, and I was staking out an old abandoned farmhouse with a Ukrainian biologist and a Ukrainian archaeologist and a group of Brits. And this old farmhouse had been abandoned since the 70s, but the Almasti was supposed to lurk around it sometimes. And one of the guys, a guy called Anatoly, had seen a 7-foot Almasti there a number of years before. And there was another story about some shepherds who were on the veranda of this old abandoned house one night, from the door at the end of the veranda swung open, and there was a 7-foot arm master there that walked along the veranda, picked one of the men up, just moved him out of the way, and jumped off the end of the veranda, disappeared back into the forest. So we set up a load of camera traps, we set out bait, fruit and meat and things, and about 10 o'clock at night there's a weird twittering noise, like a bird, and one of them, the vocalizations of the owl master, is supposed to be this weird twittering. Another guy that was with us, Gregory Panchenko, had seen one of these things, and he said it was making a twittering bird-like noise, and another witness we talked to, an old lady that had seen one, and she was a girl, said it was making this weird twittering noise. We hear this weird twittering noise, 10 o'clock at night, and one of the camera traps goes off, and I'm thinking to myself, God, can that be what I think it is?
It's right outside the door.
And then nothing happened then till about 2 o'clock in the morning. It was getting really cold, so we went into the farmhouse and huddled around an old stove to warm up. And one of my friends fell asleep, and I was there with a guy called Adam Davis, a fellow cryptozoologist, you may have heard of him. And the door to this room was slightly ajar. The door was about 7 foot tall, a big old wooden door. And there was moonlight and starlight streaming in through this crack on the door, about 3-4 inches ajar. And then from outside we hear a deep guttural vocalisation, sort of a bum 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 sort of sound. I said to Adam, have you heard that? I said, yeah. And something walked along the veranda. Whatever it was on two legs, because when it passed the doorway, it blocked out the starlight and the moonlight to a height of 7 foot plus. And I said to Adam, it's out there now, it's on the veranda. We grab our cameras, we're running out, but whatever it was had vanished into the darkness.
Oh, man.
We did a circuit of the farm and the outbuildings, but we couldn't see anything. And then in the morning, we looked at the camera traps, and all we got was vegetation moving about. So that was another one of the close calls.
The one that got away, eh?
Yeah.
So what do you think would have happened, you know, had it pushed the door open?
I would have fired off my digital camera flash right into its fucking face. Then, God knows what happens.
Because what would have expected it? Next thing you know is it comes in a room and it finds that there's 5-6 people in there. Is it going to run away? Is it going to feel threatened? Is it going to launch into an attack? What was the plan?
They suddenly run away. They're very rarely aggressive. Very rarely aggressive unless they attack. I heard one story of a guy who, in panic, threw a punch at one of them when it came up to his door one night, and it just swatted him away with an open-handed slap, knocked him clear across the room. But it didn't drive home the attack. Once it had got him out of the way, it just ran off. They very rarely, very rarely attack people. There's another one, another story about a farmer that saw one near a grain silo and he threw a stone at it, and then it lifted this massive big rock up and lobbed this rock and narrowly missed him. And in the morning, it took two men to even lift the rock up off the floor.
Wow. Just, I kind of just imagine that in my head, like, so where I work in a warehouse. I constantly move stock that's perhaps a little bit heavier than most people are generally used to. And I'm thinking, what kind of weight can I lift? What kind of size would this rocket have been? And I can kind of mentally vision what you need two people for.
A chimpanzee is about 6 times as strong as a man. A gorilla, 20 times maybe. So we're looking at something with gorilla-like strength. With the Yeti, even bigger, even more massive.
So, as a question, I guess it drops into the crypto stuff, only by association of what we're talking about here, about different forms of hominids that may have existed and perhaps, you know, perpendicular to ourselves. So, we find stories, like we talked about earlier, about trolls and ogres and stuff. So, what about giants? I do think they're a bit overstated, but I don't think they're out of the realm of possibility as something that existed in our past, particularly when they're described as only being about 9 to 10 feet tall, but very hominid-like. And when you find particular stories in our recent past and in our ancient past myths and stories, how likely are them to be creatures that were perhaps just killed off by humans or ones that perhaps were survivors or pockets of humanity or of hominids.
The Yeti, the larger type of Yeti, is supposed to be 10 feet tall. And we know from the fossil record there's a giant ape called Gigantopithecus. It's known from its teeth and jaw bones. It lived in China and Vietnam, fed mainly on bamboo and other tough, fibrous plants. Scaling it up from its jaws, which were so much more massive than the gorilla, has been postulated that it would have stood about 10 feet tall. So things like this can exist and did exist.
Because, like, I guess, taking a few holy books as an example, there's like the Samson and story. He was supposed to have been a giant of a man. Then you have the David and Goliath story, I guess. You got Goliath being a 10-foot tall person from Canaan who apparently had hairy arms and a hairy back and didn't speak very well. You know, does that mean that he was perhaps an ape-like human?
Maybe he was some sort of a hybrid, if he existed.
Yeah, of course.
Maybe he was some sort of a hybrid, because there are stories of the Almasti hybridizing with human beings. And we know that Neanderthals, Denisovans, and other species of hominids that have a ghost lineage, we haven't got the fossils, but we just infer them from the genetic makeup of certain populations of people. We know that there's a lot of interbreeding between modern humans and other hominins.
Yeah, so I guess, like you said, there's the ghost lineages, the ones that kind of split off, diverge, perhaps don't last very long. Humans and, say, chimpanzees and gorillas, generally, they're too far apart, aren't they? But would any of these other hominids perhaps be closer to us presently?
Well, we know we've got every human who's not black African has got something like 4% Neanderthal genes in them.
Yeah.
Then the people from around New Guinea, they in Tibet, they've got Denisovan in them. And there are other populations that have other hominids that we don't know about, but we've just got the genetic makeup of them and we haven't got the bones yet.
It's a matter of finding the right places and the conditions they would have survived, isn't it? And I guess also digging down, you know, far enough. there was a story I read quite recently about how scientists will only... Sorry, I think it's geologists, I think, would only dig down so far in the ground because that's all science says that should be there. And then by accident, one guy who was digging a Native American site, he dug an extra 5 feet and then continued to find more... stuff that was lower down that defied his knowledge and then went quiet for like 20 years and then wrote a book about it.
Yes, they don't like it. They don't like pre-modern Native American archaeology in North America. They'll try and stamp on it and quiet it down and suppress it.
Yeah, which really, is... Yeah.
Human remains from North America seem to be Siberian. They have links to the Siberian people.
And that's right, time, yeah.
It would have been easier to cross because the land bridges and you know, masses of ice. But it's a sort of form of racism in it that they hate anything that's not Native American, modern Native American that might be older.
No, it's not the way to do science. I guess there's plenty of evidence that's coming up now about earlier civilizations that might have existed in North America and South America and so on. Because I find it's interesting, in North America it's perhaps the only continent where there's not large mammals. There's no, like... I mean, even horses were apparently... They were indigenous there, but they were wiped out and were reintroduced back, which I thought was quite interesting.
Lots of large mammals, usually mastodons, mammoths, giant, and so forth, they all became extinct around about 10,000 years ago.
Yeah. I guess with the Younger Dryas impact, and I guess that caused America to change extremely much geologically, or sorry, on the surface at least, and the whole world appeared to have its whole face changed, effectively.
There are stories of ground sloths surviving in South America, in the jungle of South America, where they're known as Mapanguari. Not the big elephant-sized ones, but more the sort of bear-sized ones.
What's your experience with, like, say, South American stories?
I've only been to South America once, so I'd like to do much more work in South America. I went on a trail of a giant anaconda, which is an animal I find utterly fascinating. You know that the anaconda can grow to around about 27 feet, but there are persistent reports of them anywhere from 40 to 60 feet in the depths of the Amazon, the
What
Orinoco.
are they eating to maintain that kind of 40 foot?
Caimans,
That's what.
jaguars, tapirs, large fish, manatees. You've got to remember that snakes, they're cold-blooded, they've got a low metabolism, so they only need to feed once in a while. I went over there with a guy called Damon Corrie, who's a Arawak clan, Eagle Clan Arawak chief, and he took us out on the trail of the giant anaconda, and he said that some warriors, some hunters had told him that an anaconda so vast they'd run away from it, and they pointed out this dead tree in the swamp, and they said it was crawling over a tree like that, but it was much, much longer than the tree. And they fled from it. But unfortunately, when I was in South America, they were experiencing the worst drought in living memory. It was viciously hot, and we were out on a savanna area, and we were all suffering from heat stroke, and the rivers were so low that we couldn't get along to the very remote lakes where these huge snakes were
Well, that's
reported.
unfortunate.
I'd love to go back to maybe such somewhere like Peru
Oh.
on the trail of anaconda. Because anacondas don't lay eggs, they give birth to live young. And the female, she'll give birth to all these live young, she retains the eggs in her body, they hatch out inside her, and she gives birth to live young, so they don't have to come out onto land to lay eggs.
Oh.
So the anacondas are getting older and older and bigger, and nobody really knows how big they get. But if you think about a snake, 40 to 60 feet long, which is essentially a tube of muscle with teeth at one end,
Yeah.
it's terrifying prospects. The early gauchos, the cowboys, used to call them the Manotoro, the bull killer, because they say they grab full-grown bulls, constrict them, and swallow them as easily as a boa constrictor would eat a rat.
Wow. So that's just that's a visual. That's quite incredible. Because I mean, what do you think the circumference must be? I mean.
Huge, huge, about. There would be a 60-foot anaconda, I think would be about 3.5, 4 foot. It's largest. That's
I
a
mean, the
circumference.
craziest thing is, if we were to dis if that was to be found, I mean, the size of its head would be significantly a challenge for anyone who saw it, let alone decided to put it down, as it were. I mean, how much do you think tranquilizer would have to take to put that thing down?
It would be very hard to kill because not only does it have scales, but it has the thick rubbery muscles underneath, so it would be incredibly tough beast.
Yeah.
How would you transport something like that?
I guess the first thing is you've got to find it, then you've got to kill it or sedate it.
There was a story from the early part of the 20th century about a group of soldiers that were attacked by one of these things in the ruins of Fort Tabatanga, and it was supposed to have taken 500 rounds to kill him.
Incredible.
Whether there's any truth to the story or not, there's a photograph of a dead anaconda sort of lying belly up in the water, and it does look very big, but there's no frame of reference to really how large it is.
Oh, okay. So. A snake 40 foot long. But I guess that the are these the ones that also pop up in mythology as well? That the
Yeah,
yes,
get
snakes.
messages of snakes all over the world. In South America, there's one called the Suca Mama, the mother of the waters, that's a gigantic anaconda. And you get these stories from Africa as well. There's the famous case of a pilot called Remy Van Lieder, who was in World War II, he was a decorated fighter pilot. After the war, he became a charter pilot in the Congo, and he was flying over Katanga in the Congo, and he came to a clearing, And he said he saw this immense snake in a clearing. It's a dark green, it's sort of dirty yellow underbelly, massive sort of horse-shaped head. And he said it was about 50 feet long. And he said as the helicopter went past, it reared up and tried to strike at it. And they turned around, did a second circuit, and managed to get a photograph of this thing. And if you look it up online, you'll see a photograph of this huge snake. But once again, there's nothing really to give a scale. But Van Leider said he was trained to estimate sizes from being a pilot in the war, and said it was at least 50 feet long. That snake.
So what do you think, what's a snake's kind of life cycle? I mean, so do they have like a, I guess they have a finite life, but I guess, I don't know how long a typical snake would live.
The big descriptors tend to live longer than other snakes, 30 years or so. But once again, you might get these freakish individuals that live longer and get bigger.
Yeah.
I think we're not talking about a separate species. I think we're talking about freaks within or mutations within a known species.
Yeah, I would get that. I'd get that. So are there any kind of ape-like creatures that are discovered in, or mythological-wise, 14-wise, in South America?
Yes, a few. When I was over there looking for the giant anaconda, we were told about a creature called the Dai-Dai. And they say it resembles a huge man covered with hair. And our guide said there were two native children about 8 years before. And we were stopping in a village called Lethem. And they were in the next village along, and they were walking back from school to their village, a boy and a girl. And the boy turns up on his own, terrified, and he said that this huge hair-covered man, or man-like creature, came out from a stand of trees, grabbed the girl, hauled her off, and she was never seen again. And there was no official investigation because, unfortunately, native people in Guyana are treated very much like third-class citizens.
That's unfortunate.
So, yeah, there are stories of man-like creatures. They go by various names in various parts of South America. Usually they're fairly small in stature, more like the orangutan deck, but there are occasionally big ones, like the Dai-Dai.
So, I think perhaps the way we should round this off then is, do you want to share your details and what else, how people can get in contact with you? Perhaps share some of your I'm assuming you might have some kind of GoFundMe kind of thing towards your expeditions as well.
No, I don't actually, but maybe I should get one. But
I would recommend that for sure.
If people want to get in touch with me, my email is richard@cfz.org.uk. The website is the Centre for 14 Zoology, www.cfz.org.uk. I've also got a new book out. It's called Adventures in Cryptozoology, Volume 1. It's the first of a two-volume set. The second is out next year. And it covers the history of cryptozoology, the discovery of new animals. It looks at ape-like creatures like the Yeti and the Sasquatch, and things like the Mongolian death worm, which is another creature I've been on the trail of, the Beast of Jadavan, dragon-like monsters, sea serpents, lake monsters. And then in volume two, we're moving on to things like the Tasmanian wolf and the giant anaconda and supposed living dinosaurs in the Congo and other areas. And it'll also be looking at my own personal experiences and my own expedition. But that's volume two. Volume one, Adventures in Cryptozoology, is out now, and you can get it off Amazon.
Excellent, excellent stuff, man. So people can contact you, head up your website, they can find out more about what you're up to. I can see you've got a Facebook page as well. And are you active on social media? Is that something you participate in?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook, if anybody wants to contact me on Facebook.
So do you, obviously I know you spoke at the ASAP conference, do you use the ASAP as a kind of a hub as well?
Well, if people can get to me through ASAP, certainly I'm hopefully going to be speaking again next year. And I write for the magazine on and off, and I also write for 14 Times on and off.
Excellent stuff. Because there was a lady who you had a a conversation with, whose name does escape me. I literally had it to hand yesterday. I know she, of course, is a cryptozoologist follower herself. I know she has a lot of stories that are kind of first-hand. I thought was rather interesting. And what was her name?
You mean Jackie? Seen
Jackie, that's right. That's it, Jackie.
Oh, an old friend of mine, yes. Saw two Sasquatch run in front of a car she was in, 60 miles down an old logging road in, I think it was California. I was in California or Oregon, I can't remember. I think it was California. And she'd just gone down this road, not planned to do it. She'd just gone down it on a whim. She didn't really believe in Bigfoot. She was looking for other wildlife like bears, and these two creatures ran across the road in front of her. And she was in the, there was a guy in the car with her that saw them as well. 7 foot tall, muscular, covered in thick, shaggy black hair, olive coloured skin, thick brow ridge, big dark eyes, broad flat noses. And she said, they ran out from the side of the road, they stopped in the middle of the road and dithered for a bit, and she could see the faces twitching with alarm when they saw the car, and they carried on running off down this big slope.
Wow. That's literally a close encounter for sure. So that, I guess that changed her direction in life, I guess, as a wildlife participant, and into getting some more of the crypto stuff. I think I shall endeavour to follow her up with a conversation as well. So, Richard, let's draw it to a close for now, and I'm sure we'll catch up very shortly. Right, so, Richard, it's been great to have a conversation with you. It's a shame you couldn't see me on camera, but it's been fun nonetheless.
Are you interested in coming on the expedition, if you do one?
Oh, you know what? I'd love to, actually. Yeah, you know what? I'm sure I've got some time to pull in around work. If we can get some dates together, that'd be great. Thank you very much for taking the time out to join me here today. I really do appreciate it. But if I could just ask one more thing of you, you could just press like, dislike, leave a comment, or press subscribe. You could do any or all of those things, but it allows me to know whether I'm producing the kind of content that you want to listen to. I do produce a variety of content, especially on YouTube and out into the world of social media. So please, if you would, thank you very much. I'm Christian Lander. Until next time.